chapter 1, verses 19 to 33. And when we departed from Horeb, we went through all that great and terrible wilderness which he saw by the way of the mountain of the Amorites, as the Lord our God commanded us, and we came to Kadesh Barnea. And I said unto you, ye are come unto the mountain of the Amorites, which the Lord our God doth give us. Behold, the Lord thy God hath set the land before thee. Go up and possess it, as the Lord God of thy fathers hath said unto thee. Fear not, neither be discouraged. And he came near unto me, every one of you, and said, we will send men before us, and they shall search out the land, and bring us good word again, by what way we must go up, and into what cities we shall come. And the saying pleased me well. And I took 12 men of you, one of a tribe. And they turned and went up into the mountain and came into the valley of Eshcol and searched it out. And they took of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down unto us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land which the Lord our God doth give us. Notwithstanding, ye would not go up, but rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God. And ye murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hated us, he hath brought us forth out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Whither shall we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, the people is greater and taller than we. The cities are great and walled up to heaven. And moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there, huge giants. Then I said unto you, dread not, neither be afraid of them. The Lord your God, which goeth before you, he shall fight for you, according to all that he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness where thou hast seen how that the Lord thy God bare thee as a man doth bear his son, and all the way that ye went unto thee came into this place. Yet in this thing ye did not believe the Lord your God. In the Hebrew, in the present participle, you are not trusting the Lord your God, who went in the way before you to search you out a place to pitch your tents in fire by night, and to show you by what way you should go, and in a cloud by day. Amen. And this passage brings before us in vivid fashion the high stakes involved in whether or not we trust in God. Now, we don't know exactly why big difficulties suddenly come into our lives. Everything was fine, and suddenly you face these terrible troubles that could change everything in your experience. I believe one main reason why God lets us get into straits, into severe difficulties, is that when it is hard, we learn in a way we cannot learn when it is easy, to trust in God. And if we trust in God through difficulties, we find out how wonderful and how faithful and how great he is. We find him to be faithful. Great is thy faithfulness, says Lamentations. Then we get through the difficulty. God carried us through, and absolutely all of it was worthwhile because we found God faithful when it wasn't easy for us. That's how it was with the children of Israel massed on the near the banks of the Jordan, not too long after come out of Egypt and being given an opportunity to go into the promised land, although they knew it would involve fighting and difficulty. There they are. The question is, will we trust God and move as He has said into this difficulty, believing through Him we can conquer? I would say the experience of the children of Israel has always been understood in many ways to be a parable of our Christian lives. God lets us to get to the banks of different Jordans, as it were, where we face hard things. And here's the question: will we trust in God enough to move into it, believing that He is more than sufficient for the testings that we must go into if we're to be faithful to Him? So, 4 points this morning. First, God's past blessings during difficulties that we always need to keep in mind. That's verses 19 to 21. Secondly, the spies are selected to search out the new land, to figure out how great the difficulties really are. That's verses 22 and 23. Third, a divided report. That's verses 24 to 28, and we're going to look also in the 13th chapter of Numbers. Fourth, the firm promise of God given once again as they face these difficulties. That's verses 29 to 33. First of all, God's past blessing during the amazing difficulties He got them through, verses 19 to 21. It mentions here, this is known as a historical sort of prologue of how good God has been to them, and therefore has a right to demand their loyalty and their obedience in difficulty. We're reminded of how God got them out of Egypt, the strongest country in the world, and God sent the 10 plagues, and then got them to the edge of the Red Sea and opened the Red Sea and got the children of Israel through that, and then He led them through the, it's called the great and terrible wilderness, where there were many dangers. We look in Deuteronomy 8:15 for a little more on that. Deuteronomy 8:15, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness, wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, who brought thee forth water out of the rock of flint. They had been through times that would have killed any group of people if God had not been in the situation, orchestrating it invisibly. And they need to remember that as an encouragement for what they must now face. When God loves you, He doesn't pamper you in cotton wool and remove all difficulties from your life. When God loves you and wants to do something for you and through you, it is His normal way to let you face the severe difficulties of spiritual growth that test you down to the bottom of your feet, as it were, the bottom of your heart. And what God is trying to teach us is this: trust in Me. Sometimes we in a worship service affirm the Apostles' Creed, that's good. Or we say we believe the Bible, or we say we believe the Westminster Confession of Faith, that's good. We see, God is working, so we have to appropriate those truths about God in our hearts. And when we've appropriated those truths about God in our hearts, we can, with a certain amount of courage, face the trials that He has set before us. So God is setting everything up. Trust in me. That's Christianity. And particularly, God has given us the Holy Book. He has given us the history of Christians throughout the ages, and He's given us our own spiritual experience. We get a little older that we can remember. And the Lord is saying, now, when you're finding hard to face what you've got to face, there's nothing else other than old age or severe illnesses or financial shortages or whatever, difficult people. Remember how I got you through it in the past, and thus you can handle it with faith in me. I will handle it for you if you'll trust and move out to go across that river. Common sense tends to say to us, it depends on how difficult things are as to whether or not I can get through it. That's the common sense approach, and we all identify with it. I understand it. I've thought that way myself a great deal. But passages like this in Deuteronomy 1:19-33 show us it is not the severity of the current difficulties we must face that shall limit our success. Rather, it is the greatness of God and the exquisiteness of His care for us, if we trust in Him, that can handle anything He calls on us to go through. One thing you have to remember that Moses is saying to these people, naturally they were hesitant to go into the land of Canaan with hostile tribes, strong people who would be fight every inch for the territory that the Lord had given them. Moses is basically saying what God brought you through in the past was worse than what you're facing now, and He got you through it. So why should you quail? Why should you fear? Why should you give up now if you stop and think what God has already brought you through? Don't you think I can do it again? So God is saying, trust me afresh. That's what He's saying. I think about the United States and what I assume we may be facing, and if terrorism should come to these shores, I hope it won't. I don't know. What if it does? I would say this, without discounting for a moment the awful nature of radical fanatics who would gladly bomb themselves and or to kill some of us. We say, isn't that the worst thing America has ever faced? Oh, no, it's not. Bad. But our forefathers came through far worse than that in the past. God got them through it. Why should we lose our courage and our spirit and cave in now? I enjoyed reading a book a while back. I brought it for a little line or two. Don't Tread on Me, a 400-year history of America at war, from Indian fighting to terrorist hunting, by H.W. Crocker III. And he reminded me of something I remember from reading some of the great sermons of Samuel Davies in Virginia during the French and Indian War. That was one of the worst wars that our forefathers ever went through. It could have destroyed all of the British colonies on these shores. They were so outnumbered by the Indians and by the French, who were supplying the Indians and encouraging them to kill, sneak up and burn down white settlements, kill them, and so forth. Samuel Davies preached in Virginia the sermon why the Christian colonists ought to stand up and fight the French and the Indians, and it said he took off his robe, and there he had on a military uniform, and said, "I'm going, come with me." And we have forgot. Everybody remembers a little bit about the Revolution. Everybody remembers a little bit about the war between the states. But we have forgotten a conflict that came near to killing out our people and destroying these settlements. Queen was in Jamestown last week celebrating the 400th anniversary. Delighted she was here. But we forget how close Virginia and the Carolinas and other places came to being literally wiped out in the 1560s and 1660s, 70s, 80s, and on into the early 1700s. Let me quote just from this book by Crocker. In the South, there were other Indian wars. The most important for English settlement were the wars in the Carolinas, the Tuscarora War, 1711 to 1713 in North Carolina, which finally led to the tribe's defeat and exile north to become the sixth nation of the Iroquois Confederation, and the Yemassee War, 1715 to 17 in South Carolina. Some of you know where the town of Yemassee is, below Walterboro. And the Yemassee War almost drove all white settlers from the colony of South Carolina until they formed an alliance with the Cherokee and the colony of Virginia against the Yemassee. The white population of North America was only about 80,000 people, and there were untold scores of thousands of Indians. The French were helping them because the French wanted to embarrass England. They were rivals. So they encouraged the Indians, gave them lots of guns and ammunition and other things to kill out the English settlers on the East Coast, particularly the Carolina, Virginia, Ohio Valley, and then France thought they in league with the Indians to take everything. The French and the Indians plunged into the surrounding forest, taking cover in the dense foliage, and fired into the red-coated ranks of the British regiment and the blue-coated ranks of the Virginia militia. They would come out of the woods with blood-chilling war cries, the fearful snap of musket balls, clipping foliage and men, and then they would, whether living or dead, as they were able to start scalping the British and the American colonists. And there are a lot of details in here I won't go into, but I don't know that this country, I mean, we were colonies at that time, we weren't yet a country, but we were getting ready to be a country in several years. I doubt our people ever went through such a situation as that. If terrorists get into this country, we'll quit fighting them in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I can't predict that. I don't know, and their hands are free to come here. It still, in my view, bad as it would be, won't be nearly as bad as what our fourth great grandparents were facing in the Yemassee Wars and the Tuscarora Wars and the French and Indian conflict. So God got our people through it in the past. That's definite. The American Revolution was really and truly a civil war. The war between the states was not a civil war. It was a war between states. Bad. The Revolution was a civil war. Up where my father's people are from, Moore County, they were divided from one farm or plantation to the next one. Some were for the king, some were Tories, and some were for the revolution. And like in Iraq, they looked like each other. They were all English, Scottish settlers. But there were different loyalties in each farm. And for you to travel from your farm to the market town, say Fayetteville, I guess it was then called Campbelltown, you could easily be picked off by snipers, as one of my relatives was at age 16, year 1780. We recently put him up a tombstone. It was much like the thing in Iraq, just go somewhere and you would be killed. That was the revolution. One third were for the king, one third for independence, one third didn't care. And it was a terrible time. My family has kept the memory of it in letters and still on the same land, so we remember a lot of these things. But God got our people through it. Faith in God, He did not save them. Then I can think of my childhood and your childhood. Many of us in here of a similar age, I suppose, some younger. In the 1950s, the Cold War, when America had all the nuclear bombs, atomic bombs, and the Russian spies had given them the information, they had the missiles facing each other. I remember in the public schools of Lumberton being told they had civil defense signs that in case of attack, you'd go here, you'd go there, and if there was a bomb, you would get under your desk, and that might give you some protection from the rubble that came down from the school. None of us worried because it seemed unreal, but nonetheless, I do remember the situation, and we didn't know in the 1950s. How could we know that about 40 years later the Soviet Union would collapse? Largely bloodless. But in the 50s and 60s, we didn't know. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, my first year at the University of North Carolina. And who could know how we'd get out of that one? And yet, gracious God of our fathers got us through it. We need to remember that. Some people are just, seem to me, both liberal and conservative, about ready to give up and say, how are we going to get out of this thing? But look, I would say these situations in the past were worse. Here's the issue. Will we trust God as our fathers trusted Him when it was hard for them? It'd be hard for us. But if we trust God, He has charge of every bomb. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. He turneth it with us wherever He will, like the rivers of water. Proverbs 21:1. God is in charge of the whole situation. I don't know how we would be able to do it. I don't even know how our intelligence services would be able to do it. I don't know how well they've done. I can't judge that. But God is on the throne. He that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. If we trust in Him, God will get our people through it. What worries me about America is not the Islamists. That's bad. But whether or not enough of our people, the church people, I mean, will trust God. If we do that, the future is secured. If we don't, well, that's the first point. God's past blessing during difficulties must always be remembered to encourage us to face unknown times and personal dangers. Second, the spies were selected. That's verses 22 and 23. There on the banks of Jordan, this is only a short time after they came out of Egypt, obviously before the 40 years of wandering. They had a chance to go in. God gave them that opportunity. And it's a normal military procedure to send in spies to find out what you can about the country and about the folk with whom you will be in conflict. Some commentators have said they didn't have faith why they sent in spies. I don't think that's true. Moses approved of sending in spies, and he chose out 12, one from each tribe. I don't think anything wrong with that. In fact, God is a God who will let you look at difficulties quite realistically. I'm not aware in the Bible that God has ever asked you to bury your head in the sand and pretend that there's no bad, no evil, no death, no trouble. God doesn't do that. He says, look at it in the face. It will be difficult. But look up to me. I'm greater. Trust in me. You can get through it. So the spies went into the land of Canaan, the promised land, and came back. Then third, a divided report. You had a minority report from Joshua and Caleb. And they said, it's a beautiful land, a huge grape. They brought some back. Land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord promised. Yes, there are warlike tribes, but because God is so great and His promise is so firm, let's go in. We can take it. Let's trust God. That's Joshua and Caleb. That's a minority report. But then the other 10 spies, leaders of the other 10 tribes, gave a different report, a majority report, that sent chill into the very bones of the pilgrim people of Israel. These 10 distrusted the Lord when they saw how difficult the task was. It's easy to do. It's easy for me to rebuke them for distrusting God, but after all, I wasn't there. I didn't see those giants, those Anakim, kind of like the group that Goliath came from. There were certain tribes that we know from archaeology that had giantism. That sometimes happens. Huge, tall, muscular, big people. And they had strong walls. They exaggerated the 10 distrusting spies. The cities are walled up to heaven. They weren't, but they were big walls, and they were big people, and they were scary. God did not shield their eyes from looking at the difficulty. No, He didn't. But what He said was, trust in me in the face of those difficulties. Makes you think of the book of Daniel, doesn't it? The three Hebrew children, probably teenage young men. And Nebuchadnezzar said, if you don't bow down and worship me, I'm going to have you cast into the burning fiery furnace. And as the old gospel hymn says, they threw them in. They wouldn't bow, they wouldn't bend, they wouldn't burn. Remember that old gospel hymn? And the three Hebrew children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, said, we don't know what God will do, but we know He is great and holy, and we cannot worship any other god. We trust Him as we go into this fire. And they were preserved. The circumstances were impossible. Humanly speaking, I mean, God got them through it. They trusted. Same with Daniel later in the book of Daniel. Rule was passed, no praying to anybody but the king. And naturally, Daniel is God's man. He gets down on his knees three times a day facing Jerusalem and is praying to the Lord. And they cast him into the den of lions. Humanly speaking, impossible. You'd be broken apart and eaten up by the lions who were hungry. Now, Daniel would bend his knees only to the true God he trusted. He didn't know what God would do in that den of lions, but he wasn't going to disobey God. He went into a place of death trusting, and God shut the mouth of the lion and preserved his servant. It says elsewhere in Daniel, "They that know their God shall do exploits." I believe as an American people, I can't predict the future. British people and the rest of us believe in freedom and honor. I believe that God is going to give us in the future, maybe not too far future, a chance to do exploits, to show our mettle, to stand up in the face of danger and difficulty for the right and for God as our forefathers stood up. If we trust in God, situations other than war, various testings God lets come into every Christian life, we trust in God as we face that and remember who He is and what He's done, then we too shall be able to do exploits that may be seen only in heaven. And then fourth point, the firm promise of God is renewed in the face of these difficulties. That verse is 29 to 33. The firm promise of God is issued once again by the Lord before the present scary unknown difficulty. Three little things under this: a renewed promise, verses 29 to 31. Here's what God says. A mighty, majestic God of heaven stoops down like a caring father or a tender mother and says, "I will carry you in my arms in the future as I did in the past. Why do you think I'm going to drop my child now? You'll be in my arms if you trust." Let me read you from Isaiah 40. One of my beloved passages, yours too, I'm sure. Isaiah 40, verses 27 to 31. Isaiah 40, 27 to 31. "Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God? Hast thou not known?" Say, remember. When it's hard for you, stop and remember. "Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint." Say, "I feel faint." Well, yes. Give you power. "And to them that have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. And they shall walk and not faint." God says, if you will trust in me now for this thing, then I know it feels hard. I know you feel faint before it. I know you're scared. It's uncertain. But trust me. Trust me. I've carried you before. I never dropped you. I will keep carrying you if you'll trust. And then another point here. Trust on our part as believers is necessary for the promise to work for us. I'll say that again. If the firm promise of God that He makes to get you through difficulties going to work in your life, you have got to participate by trusting in Him. Let me read you from Psalm 95, verses 7 to 11. Or verse 8 to 11. Harden not your heart as in the provocation and as in the day of temptation in the wilderness, when your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my work. 40 years long was I grieved with this generation and said, it is a people that do err in their heart, and they have not known my ways, unto whom I swear in my wrath that they should not enter into my rest. They could have entered into rest and not had to wander 40 years if they had trusted. Now, Hebrews 4:18 takes the same passage from Psalm 95, which is referring to the time in the wilderness. Hebrews 4, verses 1 and 2, and comments on it. Hebrews 4, 1 and 2 is an inspired commentary on what all this means. Let us therefore fear lest a promise being left us of entering into His rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached. The gospel is equivalent to entering the promised land. All right? For unto us was the gospel preached, as well as unto them. But the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. What is he saying? I'm not a cook, but I know a little bit, and I know that, say, a woman's going to make a cake and put in the dry measures, flour, sugar, and so forth. But then, for the cake to mix and rise, you've got to put in the wet measures, the milk or pound of butter or vanilla or whatever, eggs, whatever goes in a pound cake. Stir it and stir it. I remember some of the older members of our family said you stirred a pound of cake before you had to mix it 100 times with a big wooden spoon. All right, and now if you don't mix in the wet measures with the dry ingredients, you don't have cake. Now, that's kind of a superficial illustration, but it brings out the point that the firm promises of God for them to become real for you and to rise and you can delectably eat them and enjoy them and pass them out, it's got to be mixed with something that comes from you. God gives it to you, yes. Faith is a gift, Ephesians 2:8 and 9. But you've got to bring your faith when God says, I'll do this, I'll get you through these difficulties, but you've got to trust me. So then you add your faith. Yes, he gives you the faith, but you can choose to bring it forward and mix it into the mix. Say, God will carry me in His arms through this if He has in the past, and it will work. Or you can say, it's too dangerous, it's too scary, I don't want to be involved. And we fail. The promises of God are given us in order that they may be trusted by us personally. That is the test for every one of us. That's the test. Whether we're going to make it through the hard times. Will we trust in God? Moses says, if you don't trust, or because you're not trusting, you're going to lose. You're going to go down in defeat. We'll look at that next Sunday. I'm not going to talk about that today. Faith, close with a word on trust. We can overdo some things. We can overdo many things. But we can never trust God too much. I don't believe any man or woman is going to come to the end of their life if they still got their mind and say, oh dear, I trusted God too much. You won't ever say that. you'll say with the hymn, "Oh, for grace to trust thee more." Probably most of our personal failures when we went down and tasted bitter defeat in difficulty finally come from our having failed to trust God, remembering what He did for us in the past. We forget it. Another hymn, "Tell Me the Old, Old Story," there's a line, "Tell me the old, old story, for I forget so soon. The early dew of morning passes away at noon." I forget so soon the past mercies of God to His people in my life. Especially when I face another round of testing, it's just like the dew has gone away under the noontime sun, and I'm dry and I'm weak and don't know what to do. God says, "I have set up the world in such a way that for you to advance spiritually and personally, you've got to trust in me." Now, I know if I were teaching students, somebody might raise a hand and say, "But I thought we were Calvinists. Doesn't Calvinism teach the sovereignty of God, that God will get everything accomplished He wishes?" Yes, the Bible teaches that. Ephesians 1:11, "God worketh all things after the counsel of His will." So here's the point. God has set up the world, put us in His image, human personalities. He set it up so His program marches forward as His people mingle their faith with His promises as they face difficulties. You might say, then how is God going to get His will done if people sometimes don't trust Him like the Israelites didn't? See, next week, it takes another 40 years. Well, the answer to that is this. There are mysteries that I wouldn't be able to explain, but I can tell you this. If you don't trust God in these difficulties, somebody else will. God knows how to get His purposes accomplished. He will do that. But He gives you and me a chance to move forward in His army, in His pilgrim people. And He says, "Trust me, and I can do important things through you if only you'll trust." And you might say, "Well, what if some Christians don't mingle their faith and the cake doesn't rise, as it were? What then?" God can raise up somebody else to trust. He never leaves Himself without a witness. Jesus once said, "If these children were not praising me, God could cause the very stones to cry out." What happens if we don't trust doesn't mean that we have defeated the purposes of God. That's impossible. What it does mean is we miss out on the blessings of victory and growth, more struggle, greater victory, greater growth, bringing honor to God and touching many people we know. God gives each one of us this opportunity in the difficulties that He lets come in our life, looming before us. "Trust me in this. I've carried you in my arms in the past. I won't drop you if you'll believe. And face it with courage. I'll give you all the strength and indeed all the courage you need. And you'll be glad you did, and you'll have a part in advancing my holy purpose." May it be so with each of us. Amen.